This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports Show. I'm Scarlett Fu along with Mike Lynch, and today we are joined by Isis Tillis. She's currently an associate attorney for labor and employment, but you might know her as the former All-America basketball player at Duke University and the three-time All-ACC selection, the former WNBA first-round draft pick. And of course, she played for the Detroit Shock, New York Liberty, and LA Sparks. So she's a big household name in pro and college basketball, and now she's a big household name as a labor attorney. Isis, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I'd like to hear a little bit about your transition from sports to the legal world. How did that come about? Was that always the plan, or is that something that you had a chance to think about after your professional career?
It was really always part of my plan. When I was a kid, this lady told me that I was going to be an attorney one day, and it sort of stuck with me. And so when I started playing basketball, in the back of my mind, I always knew that once basketball was finished, that, you know, I wanted to go to law school. And it pretty much stuck all the way through. And when I got ready to retire, I sort of took a step back and went back and looked at some of my goals and stuff as a child. And I'm very goal-oriented, and I decided to go ahead and take that leap. And I look at it, I always tell people I basically transitioned from the basketball court to the court of law. And I really used all of the skills and stuff that I learned and developed in basketball, and it really did help me to be able to get through law school. But it has been one hell of a transition, I will tell you. Mm. It's switching from purely physical to strictly cerebral, it was a definite challenge. But like I said, the skills that you learn as a professional athlete, they're definitely transitory, and they can be applied in almost any industry.
Hi, Isis. This is Mike up in Boston. Great chatting with you. So give me an example of that. Like, you're tired and all of a sudden your brain kicks in and say, okay, it's fourth quarter, 4 minutes to go. This is where we separate the winners from the losers. Is that type of thing takes over in your brain automatically?
Automatically. And it works the same, same way here in the law. It's almost like I have started to learn how to break down the legal world, and I do it the same way I used to break down my opponents on the court. And I really look at everything as sort of an analogy. On the court, you know, you have your referees. In the courtroom, you have your judges. And you have good ones and you have bad ones. You know, sometimes they call the game in your favor. Sometimes they won't. And it's really that way. You start to look at your, opposing counsel as the opponent. And you start to break them down. Are they prepared? Mm-hmm. You know, did they really prepare for this case the way that you did? And it operates the same way in the basketball world. You know, you prepare for a team sometimes weeks in advance. You have scouting reports. You know, you put in all this work, and then when you hit the court and it's game time, it's supposed to flow. And it really works the same way in the legal field as well.
So given all that, I imagine you must have been fascinated by the whole decision by the NCAA to put in place the name, image, and likeness policies that allow college players to monetize their name, image, and likeness in a way that you couldn't as a college player.
Yes, I've been looking. I'm actually very happy for the players that they, have gotten this. It's been a long time coming. I think over 100 years that the NCAA has been in charge here, and it's very fair. You know, no one has to come out of pocket here. I've been following this, the name, image, and likeness stuff for a while, starting with, the O'Bannon case and the Supreme Court's antitrust concerns, all the way down to California's Fair Pay to Play Act, which basically, forced the NCAA to make a move because it was in direct conflict with the NCAA. And then from there, we have, talks at the federal level trying to see what legislation could be had to try to regulate what's coming. See, California is one of those states, they're so large and they had so many different schools you know, if California were to, you know, pull out, it would really affect all schools, and mm-hmm. all schools might think to do something similar. So that's, in my opinion, why the NCAA had to go ahead and come out with its new interim policy, because it's way too much at stake. Society is really ready for it, and it's a fair thing to do, to go ahead and allow the athletes to at least be able to profit, you know, off of their off of who they are.
Mm-hmm. So Isis, can name and image and likeness at a school, for instance, Paige Buchers does this great deal now with and so long overdue with Gatorade. Can it be a divisive force, though, in the locker room between the haves and the have-nots?
Yeah, and, you know, I was discussing this with a few of my basketball friends. And, you know, that team dynamic, like when you're on a team, teammates are very good at being humble, I think. I haven't really run into a situation where I felt like, you know, there would be some animosity there if, you know, there's a star player that's sort of getting all the, you know, endorsements and everyone is not. We do live in a capitalist society, you know, how I look at it. And it's competitive. And, you know, unfortunately, you'll have, you know, star players and you'll have those that are not, or just role players. But one thing that is interesting is that with these endorsement deals, I think people are going to be pleasantly surprised by the fact that a lot of, say, local hometown heroes or people who aren't necessarily stars on the team that maybe decide to stay in their hometown and play. Like if I decided to stay and play at TU instead mm-hmm. of going to Duke, and this and you know we were able to use our name, image, and likeness. I've seen deals recently be given to local hometown heroes, people that are not stars, and get sponsorship deals by local mom and pops. So it's really wide open right now.
That's interesting. It could reshape the landscape for where players decide to play, and you know, teams that may not have been competitive otherwise could now be extremely competitive.
Exactly, and that's why I said you never know what type of sponsorship deals are going to come about. You've got group deals, you've got individual deals, you've got deals going to, you know, the star players, you've got deals going to, you know, the bench players. It just, you know, it just depends. But the good thing is that the schools don't have to come, they don't have to come out of pocket, and the players don't have to deal with that, with the stigmatizing rules that came with the NCAA if you, you know, so dare to violate their mm-hmm. their pay-to-play and improper inducement prohibition.
And I know that every state has different rules, but should players be able to put that money in their pocket and use it right away, or should it be held in escrow until they graduate or leave school?
I think the responsible thing would be, you know, to do the latter, to put the money in, you know, up in escrow, but then also at the same time, you know, it is their money. I don't think that it should be dictated, but what I do think should be had is I think that the universities and stuff could, you know, come up with, you know, classes or something, some type of, you know, financial literacy classes, something to help the players to manage their money.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And it'd be an ongoing thing, not just here's a seminar over the weekend. No, it has to be like an ongoing process.
You know, I want to pick up on that. I don't mean to jump in, Scarlett,
no, go ahead.
Because I'm involved in this program in Massachusetts. It's called Credit for Life. And we just had one a week ago Friday at a school. It was a vocational school. And there were different stops along. It's like a fair. And one is housing, one is transportation, and they give the kids this these apps, and they go around and they pick a profession, and they have to decide, you know, oh, here's my rent is $1,800, here's $60 for utilities, oh, I want to buy a new car, or I want to buy a 10-year-old used car. And they at the end, they come over to the table, and they show us their app, and they say, whoa, wait a minute now, you have your $2,500 in the hole. And every one of them has their mouth open, and they're like the old VA commercial, they're slapping themselves on the forehead. And, You know, no disrespect to some of the courses we all took in high school that we'll never use again, like, you know, like chemistry and da-da-da-da-da. I just would love to see this be mandatory, starting at the grassroots level, the high school level. And I'm sure, you know, representing a lot of players in your position now, you see this as a big problem. Am I correct, Isis?
Absolutely, I do. When you go to rookie orientation on the men's in the WNBA or and in the NBA, they have some type of, like, you know, brief financial literacy little seminar that they have during rookie orientation, and that's pretty much it.
So it's perfunctory.
Right, and it really needs to be, I mean, it's a problem. It is, and it's a problem that can be remedied with genuine instruction.
I feel like it's going to be a bigger problem, too, with the rise of NFTs and crypto as well, where people are intent on getting paid sometimes in crypto, which can be a good thing, but you need to understand all the implications, the consequences, the risks that go along with that.
Exactly. And that's why there needs to be, you know, sometimes some ongoing classes that are not just, oh, for one semester. It needs to be something that's ongoing. I mean, especially, you know, society is just changing so much that we need to really address the financial literacy aspect because it's going to be this, you know, the NIL policy, it's going to be huge, and it's going to affect all athletes from, you know, those who, you know, might come from households of lower socioeconomic value to, mm-hmm. you know, people that might come from wealthier homes. Everyone is going to be affected. Everyone needs to know how to move. And what's interesting about right now is that it's wide open. So the NCAA is allowing the universities to sort of create their own policies. You know, how do they want to deal with these endorsements? Do they want the players to keep a log of all the endorsement deals that they have? You know, what mechanisms will the universities put in place to make sure that the players don't run afoul of the pay-to-play and the improper inducement piece of the NCAA bylaws that are huge? Those are the two that the NCAA has plainly, you know, stated over and over that they will continue to enforce those. But as far as the endorsement goes, that's really just left up to the states and the schools.
They're making it up as they go along.
Right. Until, you know, the lawsuits start coming in, and, you know, and then that's when you start to be able to narrow things down some. But right now, it's really just, it's really wide open.
Is that where you would come in when the lawsuits start popping up?
That's where I come in.
Off the bench. Here she comes.
That's where I come in. But, you know, we also, you know, we also do, you know, policy drafting and training and other preventative, you know, measures and stuff for employers to take. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this, it's just, I don't know, for me, I think it's so exciting because there's so many different pieces to it. You know, you have, you know, the players and their endorsements, and you have the actual sponsors themselves, and then you have the schools, and then you have the states. And another piece that's really interesting that I don't hear a lot of people talking about is the fact that this rule also reaches to seniors, to high school seniors.
Right. Hmm. That could, you know, be a game changer.
That's huge.
Yeah.
You know, when you were playing, you had a plan. You knew you were going to be an attorney someday. But most people don't, men and women. They think that professional sports and what they're doing is going to last forever. Mm-hmm. How do you give a reality check to those people that think it's going to last forever?
Good question.
I would tell them it absolutely does not last forever. And when you, especially those people who've played at the highest level like I have, it is a it's a rude awakening out here in the real world. It really is. No matter how prepared you even try to be, when you are no longer in the sports world, sports is a microcosm within itself, and it is very awkward to have a quote unquote real job for the first time. You know, in society, you realize you have to do. There's so many things that you don't know how to do. Mm-hmm. You're almost handicapped a little bit, and you have to figure everything out. It's been ten years this November since I retired, and I finally feel like I'm in lockstep with everyone else in society. With everyone else in
really?
Society. Yes.
What was the hardest thing you had to learn how to do?
Really just not being around other athletes was very different. I used to tell my former teammates all the time, like, you guys don't understand. That team dynamic, it is very special. Mm-hmm. Everyone, when you're on a team, everyone sort of, you know, works well together, knows how to get along. And everyone can be competitive without obviously competing, if that makes sense.
Competitive together, but not against each other?
Exactly, because you can sort of shine in your own way, you know what I mean, by just being an individual. But in the real world, it is a constant, competition. And, everything is, you've got to learn how to play the politics, you know, of the particular job. And you do have to do that, a little bit, in sports. But it's more so behind the scenes. But that to me was like a huge awakening for me. It was like, wow, okay, I really have been sheltered. Mm-hmm. A little bit. That was very, very difficult for me to sort of get out here and just be amongst people. I felt like I was at a major disadvantage. I mean, it took me years to finally feel, like I was like everyone else. There were a lot of things that I didn't know. And so you just have to kind of get in there and dig in there and figure it out. And I would tell all the athletes to take your future seriously, because not everyone is meant to be a coach. I've always known that about myself. I knew that I didn't want to coach one day. Mm-hmm. I always knew that. I was like, that's not my forte. I knew I wanted to be a lawyer. And so I kept that goal in mind and put a target date as to when I would retire. And that target date was 30, and that's exactly what I did. I stuck to that. Other people, they wait until it's retirement time, and they are absolutely clueless. And oftentimes they will fall into coaching when that's really not what they want to do. Mm. And so I always encourage players, listen, there's nothing that you can't do. If you put your mind to it, if you want to go to medical school, you can do that. You know, you'll apply the same mindset that you had in basketball or whatever sport you're in, mm-hmm. to your new field, and you will be fine. Yes, it will be awkward, it will be difficult, but with the strength of the athlete's mind, the athlete can overcome. And I would love to see more athletes pursuing their true passion.
Isis, how often do you hear from a former teammate or opponent that says, Isis, I've lost my compass. I need some help. I don't have any direction now that it's over.
All the time. All the time. And especially now, recently, I've had so many of my friends and stuff that, growing up playing together from AU to high school to college to pros. And a lot of the girls are a little lost and need some guidance, and also to hear from someone that's been there. Mm-hmm. Like, I've been there. I actually went through the struggle all by myself. I was kind of one of the first ones, and so I'm able to sort of give them some guidance. And particularly what they like the most is the fact that I'm being realistic. Like, you can, I always encourage them, hey, if you want to go to business school, you should really pursue that and don't let that fall by the wayside because you're nervous about, taking the GMAT. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Don't let a standardized test, deter you from pursuing whatever your passion is. That's oftentimes what it is. It's the dumb athlete stereotype, to be honest, that keeps athletes from being able to pursue their dreams after their basketball career.
Well, we're glad it didn't deter you. You've gone on to do great things. Isis, thank you so much for joining us. This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports podcast. I'm Scarlett Fu, here along with Mike Lynch. Be sure to catch us each and every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday, where we explore the world of money and sports. And, of course, you can find us on Twitter. I'm @ Scarlett Fu.
And I'm Mike Lynch. You can follow me at LynchyWCDB.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports on Bloomberg Radio around the world.